Alex Gladstein, it's good to have you back, man. How's everything going?
It's great. Just got back from a trip to Asia. Was hanging out with Bitcoiners in Korea and in Bali, so I'm pretty energized.
Yeah, indeed. I know you wrote this book quite a while ago, but the Hidden Repression book, I think, has quite a lot to say about like some of these countries that you visited that you've been working with. So I want to get started with this whole thing about the book. What inspired you to write the book, and what were you hoping to what message were you hoping to give to the audience that you had?
Yeah, well, I think that Bitcoiners are naturally skeptical of alphabet soup organizations like the IMF and unelected global organizations like the World Bank in general. And some of my work over the years had touched on it a little bit. For example, we know that the IMF worked with the French government to impose a currency devaluation in Africa, in across 15 countries that used the colonial franc currency, meaning, the citizens had no choice. One day their money was just worth half of what it was worth the night before, and that was something the IMF imposed. And we knew that they do that so that like old empire countries like France can get cheaper exports from those poor African countries. That's why they do like currency devaluations, right? And IMF and World Bank types are always talking about how it can be really helpful because it can help the local government raise more revenue. They never talk about the human impact, of course, the fact that it's going to dramatically lower living standards for everybody, except for like the handful of elites who are running the import-export businesses. And I mean, just how outrageous to decide to just nuke the savings of everybody, especially in countries where people don't have access to, rent-seeking financial products, where there's no ability for them to get what the cantillionaires can get. I mean, it's a massive crime, in my opinion, to do that. So we knew that they were up to no good in certain areas, but I noticed one day I just was digging around and I was like, I would love to read like a book about the IMF, and there really wasn't one. I mean, there wasn't one in the way that I would like it to be. There wasn't a Big Short style book, something approachable. There wasn't something pop culture-esque. There wasn't even really a good overview. There was a lot of stuff that touched, of course, on globalization, which we'll get to, especially coming out of the late 90s, protests against it. And there were a couple arguably fiction books about the topic, like Confessions of an Economic Hitman. I mean, we've no idea how accurate some of that stuff is. And, so you've either got the Naomi Klein stuff where, the solutions are some sort of socialism, right? Or you have these testimonies from people. You don't know how reliable they are. And I just didn't feel like there was a good book that explained the mechanism of how they worked. So I thought that was curious, and I just started reading as much as I could, and I just read books and started using JSTOR a lot, just reading a ton of papers from the 50s and 60s and 70s. Started coming across books from that era, started looking at their references, looking at those books, went down this massive rabbit hole, started to interview people on the topic, and all of a sudden I'm looking at 20,000 words, and I've got, a book. It was definitely a long journey for me, more kind of morally, I think, was the most interesting part, because you start to realize that like our societies in the West are heavily dependent on exploitation of poorer countries. And I think that most people sort of know that. There's like an inkling of that, and I certainly knew that partially that was true, but I just didn't know how heavily dependent we were on poorer countries. And globalization, I mean, what it really means is like our ability to penetrate these poor places and exploit them. I mean, that's really what it means. It's not some sort of free trade Adam Smith, free for all. Oh, you make what you're good at, we'll make what we're good at. No, that's not it. That's not what's going on here. This is a highly centralized, highly rigged game. And it's an outgrowth of World War II and the end of the British Empire and the beginning of the American Empire. And it's an outgrowth of the institutions that were built at the end of World War II. And it's part of Bretton Woods. It's a very important part of Bretton Woods. I mean, the IMF, World Bank, WTO, or the GATT. I mean, these things all came out of that gathering. And it was basically like, how are we going to set up this new global economy? And of course, it was like only a handful of elites in certain countries who got to decide. And they were primarily creditor nations, right? So these are nations that by the late 60s were the ones lending. I mean, you could think about it as in the international economy, I mean, they were the bankers and everybody else was borrowers, and they got to dictate terms. And I traced in this book how the backstory of the creation of these institutions and how they basically pivoted their focus from helping to rebuild Europe and Japan, which is what they were supposed to do in the first place, to really exploiting mineral wealth and commodities and raw materials and cheap labor in what is known as the global south, or what I would like to call the global majority, where most of the people live and where most of the world's resources are. And it's pretty tragic to start to understand this, and it just shapes a lot of your other thinking, I guess. Yeah.
Well, I want to touch on that a little bit because you mentioned that a lot of your sort of insight was in a way pretty convicting because you're beginning to realize just how exploitive this whole thing is. What were your impressions of these organizations, say, before you got into Bitcoin and like probably where a lot of people that don't know anything about Bitcoin, like where they are with these organizations, what's the general impression that they give to the general public, and how is it different from reality?
Right. So, I mean, I looked at two institutions in this book closely. There are, of course, many, many other lending institutions. Some are bilateral. So, of course, like the British government has its own thing, for example. I mean, the US has all kinds of organizations. We have like the export import bank. We have all kinds of things, all kinds of institutions. China has its own set of institutions that I touch on in the book. But ultimately, the lender of last resort in the world economy remains the IMF, and the world's largest development bank remains the World Bank. So I wanted to look at those two institutions in particular. My sense was that most people kind of thought of the World Bank as some sort of neutral institution. I didn't really see a whole lot of negativity around it. I do think that a lot of people questioned the IMF, or at least what it was doing. But they would often say, well, the IMF might be bad, but the World Bank, is probably fine. That's, I think, what the general kind of neoliberal like establishment opinion, it seems, is. Now, of course, for people in the global majority, I mean, they know exactly what's going on, and they know that both of these institutions are terrible because whenever their governments would take a loan from one of these institutions, everything would go to shit. So, they know. The book is not for them. The book is for us. The book is for people in the West to understand, like, what are the implications of the system that we built, and how can we credit some of the civilization that we've built? Like, what has it come at the expense of? I think that these are the deep, deep questions you get when undergoing this kind of research. But at the end of the day, the book looks at these two institutions in particular.
Well, okay. So let's start with some of the stuff that you talk about in the book. Let's start with the debt trap. What is the debt trap, and how do countries get caught in it?
And to finish the previous point, the perception is again that these institutions might be, problematic but necessary, or maybe they're corrupt, or maybe someone will publish a study and be like, look, it's not working. The IMF is impoverishing this country. My radical thesis is that no, it's actually working. Like, the point of these institutions is to impoverish countries. They argue that their goal is to end poverty, That's a huge slogan they put up on their headquarters in DC. The bank and the fund share a big headquarters. They're not interested in ending poverty. I hate to break it to you. They're interested in actually exacerbating poverty. And there's reasons for that. I mean, you know, when we talk about the debt trap, it's useful to think about the motives for these organizations. You know, what do they do? What do they do for the creditor nations that set them up? Well, they do a couple things. The first thing they do is they make them money. They're profitable. I mean, people should remember that these are not altruistic charitable institutions. They don't give grants, generally speaking. I mean, these are lending institutions that lend at a very high rate of interest. So not only do you have 6, 7, 8% interest rate, that was like the norm for many, many decades for a lot of these countries, you have a double standard, or essentially two classes of players here, where you have the wealthy nations, which get access to cheap capital, they can borrow for cheaply, and then they park that at the World Bank or IMF, and they can, and then those officials can lend that money out at really high rates. So there's some arbitrage here. I mean, they can make money off the spread. It's pretty wild, but in any event, they make many billions of dollars a year just off the business of lending. Like that's number one. There's also something called the double loan, which is really interesting and dark. So, for example, a country like Britain might lend either through the IMF World Bank or even just by itself to like a former colony, like Bangladesh, let's say. And let's say it gives 100 million pounds to Bangladesh for some project, a loan at some interest rate. Let's call it right now. I mean, today, I mean, we're probably talking like 9 or 10%, right? You know, given interest rates and where they are. Okay, so it's like a, whatever, 20-year loan or something to Bangladesh for $400 million for aquaculture, you know, basically engineering the geoengineering farms into shrimp factories, let's put it that way. That's like something that has happened, something like that. Okay, so what happens is, what's interesting here is often for infrastructure projects, the loan will be made to the local government, Bangladesh, 100 million pounds. It pretty much immediately gets spent on setting up the project. And guess what? Guess who gets paid to do that? British companies. So what's really crazy is, you know, in many cases, the loan would go out and it would come right back. So like the British economy would give 100 million pounds. And then that money would come right back to the British economy within a few years, or a lot of it would, in some cases, all of it. And then the taxpayer in Bangladesh is left on the hook for 100 million pounds plus interest. So they're going to have to pay back 150 million. So this is where you can start to see some of the dynamics here. So A, it makes a lot of money for the lenders, like in different ways in the lending economies. B, it's political, right? So there's something called structural adjustment. So whenever the bank, whenever the fund and whenever the bank since about 1980 or so lends, the recipient country isn't just on the hook to pay back the loan with interest. The recipient country must oblige by a variety of conditions, which are known as structural adjustment, which is really just code speak for austerity. So basically, like, for example, this might include currency devaluation, raising taxes, shrinking the banking system, cutting all subsidies for poor people on all kinds of food and energy stuff, healthcare, education, etc. I mean, it's basically think of whatever we have in America or Europe or Japan, whatever like democratic politicians like refuse to cut is just cut immediately in these poor countries. And, you know, even if, like on paper, we know that subsidies are bad. There's some nuance here. Number one, yes, subsidies are bad, but if you're poor and you've had cheaper fuel or cheaper wheat, and all of a sudden it gets really expensive, I mean, you're going to starve. I mean, that's number one. Number two, there's double standard here. So what's happening is that through these conditions, the creditor nations who lend the money, they are forcing these poor countries where most of the world's people live to basically streamline spending, government spending, to avoid any sort of welfare so that the labor costs are as cheap as possible. Meanwhile, at home, they are spending lavish amounts on welfare. So, for example, Britain has the NHS. America has a very inefficient but very expensive national healthcare system that targets part of the population. We have Social Security. We have all these things. I mean, the largest single expenditure of the American budget every year is welfare. So you have welfare states in the West who impose these conditions on these very poor countries where people make a few dollars a day. And they basically say, you need to get rid of all your welfare. And again, in theory, subsidies are corrupting the market. We all know that. But when there's a double standard and you have this rich country which has tons of welfare and subsidies, especially agricultural subsidies, dictating terms to these little countries and making them end all their subsidies, I mean, it makes for a very stark outcome. It's a total double standard, and that's the real problem here. So these conditions include, again, currency devaluation, basically a reduction in purchasing power for the local population and an increase in purchasing power for rich people. So this is the dynamic you're starting to see. Like, this is what colonialism always tried to do way back when, was the British or the Spanish or whoever, Japanese, they would send out ships with guns and they would steal gold and resources and they would enslave people and they would make cheap labor so that the living costs in London or Berlin or New York or whatever could get subsidized, would get cheaper for those people. So increasing purchasing power at home, decreasing purchasing power over here. This is the game. This is the point of colonialism, and this is the point of what I would call debt colonialism, which is how the IMF and World Bank operate. So that's the second piece. And then the third piece is this like geoengineering thing. Like, basically, these countries are engineered to become dependent on the West. So it's not enough that the West gets to make money off this operation. It's not enough that they get to kind of politically squeeze them so that we get a better trade balance. There's a third element here, and that is that we change the economy. We change the physical infrastructure of the economy to make things that we want instead of things that they need. And this creates dependence. So, for example, Africa imports 85% of its food. This makes no sense at all. Africa should be, by any standard, the breadbasket of the world. But because of trade policy and because of the lending and the practices we've been able to force on these countries, instead they have to import all their food. And this makes them really, really dependent, and it basically makes them, subsidiary to us. I mean, they have to follow what we want. And I'll give you some examples. Like, so the problem with this system, and some people say the dollar hegemonic system was forced into existence and gold was defeated or whatever. Other people say that the free market has expressed a preference for a common currency like English with language, and the euro dollar market is evidence that everybody wants dollars. Fine. It doesn't matter to me. It doesn't matter to us. Whether it was political or market based, it doesn't matter. The fact is that the dollar system creates a world where a handful of countries can essentially print money to buy valuable things, and everybody else cannot. So if you're Ghana or Malawi in Africa, for example, or the Philippines or Indonesia or Brazil or whatever, you cannot print your currency to buy fertilizer, tractors, oil, the things you need to develop as a nation. You cannot print your own currency to buy dollars either, because then you go into hyperinflation. What you have to do in this system, regardless of how the system was built, the reality is you have to trade with the United States to earn dollars, or trade with one of our allies to get dollar substitutes. It's the only way. So you have to like trade, and that means you need to make something that they want. And oftentimes the thing that your country needs to survive is not what they want. I mean, that what they want, what do we want? We want coffee, tea, cocoa, uranium,
Oil.
Gold, oil. We want raw materials and commodities. We do not want to be buying cars from Senegal. We want to make the cars, and we want to sell them to Senegal. Okay? So you start to see what's happening here is just a massive excavation of resources and a complete stripping of labor standards so that we get stuff as cheap as possible. So we've shaped these economies so that instead of raising cattle and growing rice and vegetables and things that they need to survive. They're growing shrimp that they don't eat, that they just sell to us. Or they're growing tea, which they can't even eat, or palm oil, or cocoa, or they're digging shit out of the ground and selling it to us. I mean, basically, whatever can provide the least benefit for the local population is what they sort of target in these schemes. So to recap, the whole system is premised on making money, A, B, changing the trade system so that, you know, we benefit, and mm-hmm. and C, changing the economies of poor countries so that they become dependent on us.
Yeah, and this is something that you cover very well in this book, and I'm glad that you gave a summary of like what an IMF structural adjustment means. The thing that really struck me, and this is something that you mentioned.
Oh, sorry, Jimmy. The result of this is what we call the debt trap. So just to be very clear, in early 1970, at the end of the gold system as it was dying, basically, a country like Bangladesh might have $100 million in external debt. Today, after 50 years of the fiat system, they have $100 billion in external debt. That is what's called the debt trap. So policymakers in the 70s knew this. They knew there was no way these countries were going to start to be able to repay their debt. The only option is to get more debt into the system. And this is one of the reasons the system keeps growing. I mean, the sovereign bond market is massive. The sovereign debt market is massive. And the reason is the incentives are aligned this way. So like the Western banks that ultimately have these loans to these poor countries or these dictators on their balance sheet. If the dictator comes back and says, like when Mobutu and Zaire, he would come back and say, we're not paying this loan. Like, screw you. The IMF would actually go back, because then the IMF would go talk to its creditors or whatever. They'd all talk and they'd say, well, we could write off the loan and reduce our balance sheet, or we can lend him more money and we can increase our balance sheet, right? So that's the incentive. So they would go back to Mobutu and say, don't worry about it, dude. Here's another billion. And that's just the incentive of the system. There's never an incentive to shrink, to deleverage. There's never, never, never an incentive to do that. So the debt trap keeps growing and growing and growing and growing.
Yeah, a couple of things that you mentioned that really struck out to me is one, all of the money that is lent out to a country comes almost immediately back to the country. So it's really not that you are lending them money. You're lending them really goods and services from your own country, right? Like it's basically if you're using that money to go and build a bridge or something, you're you're selling them stuff, but you're enslaving them for some amount of time for them to get it.
And also to distinguish that the borrower is a government, which is usually an unaccountable or an authoritarian government, right? Which takes the loan, which the loans are always in dollars, by the way. So the loan comes in. Okay, great. Now the dictator, like Marcos in the Philippines in the 70s and 80s, great. He gets $2 billion. What is he going to spend it on? He's not going to build the bridge. He's not going to build a dam. He's not going to give power to his people. He's going to give his wife a wing in a museum in Paris. He's going to buy $100 million of gold. He's going to buy a whole bunch of weapons from Boeing, right? You know, it's like the system. So the vast majority of the borrowing done over the last 50 years of the system has not trickled down to the people. In fact, it's been immediately spent by the corrupt elites. So that's another very important thing. And they don't have to pay it back. They know they're not going to have to pay it back. So it's on the shoulders of the taxpayer of the country. And there's never any idea of a debt jubilee. A debt jubilee has been part of human culture since Babylon, since biblical times, since way back when. There would be debt jubilees. This was a normal thing. And I'm not saying that's necessarily a good idea to do now or not. I mean, that's not really our conversation here. But what's interesting is that's never considered, even though the United States has a legal precedent of doing this. So there's this concept of odious debt where when the U.S. defeated the Spanish Empire about 100 years ago, we told the Cuban people they didn't have to pay the debt that the Spanish Empire had incurred in Cuba because they were enslaving them. That's called odious debt, and there's an American legal precedent for that. The IMF and World Bank have never followed that. So, for example, you have Marcos in the Philippines tossed out in a people power revolution in the mid-80s. The following year, the people who tossed him out, 40% of their national GDP had to go to paying interest on the debt that Marcos had borrowed, even though they had not elected him. That's how corrupt and broken the system is. So, you know, there is no precedent for this, meaning there's no precedent. There is a precedent, but no one's ever acted on it. The only example I could really find was when we invaded Iraq, we like wrote off some of the debt, which now we were the occupying power, right? So that was interesting. But anyway, generally speaking, there's no ability to write off this debt, and it just snowballs. Like Argentina, like people are still paying back debt in Argentina from the military dictatorships of the 70s and 80s. It's terrible.
The people that take out the loans don't end up paying the loans, in other
No,
words.
yeah, they
It's just
usually are long gone by the time that the loan has to be restructured. And these, you know, IMF loans are usually shorter term loans, 2, 3, 4, 5 years. World Bank loans can be longer, 10, 20, 30. Either way, what happens is they get restructured. So like almost always, you know, it's time to pay everything and the country hasn't paid it. Oh, okay, we'll restructure it, which usually just means they like raise the interest rate. You know, because these are assets that are tradable, right? Like, so whatever, like Bangladesh's debt it owes to the IMF World Bank. I mean, these are assets somewhere. So they have a value on them, right? And they fluctuate. But, you know, to keep that value up, the interest of the system is to just give more debt so that the old debt at least has a chance of being paid back, right? So that it doesn't go to zero. Because it's funny, if the debt that Bangladesh owed went to zero, I mean, that would not damage the average day laborer in Bangladesh at all. Who damages a bank in London, to be clear. Like, that's how the system works. It's kind of screwed up.
Well, so in other words, whenever you do these IMF restructurings, you're stealing from the poor people and paying back the rich people, loans that they really shouldn't have made in the first place,
Well, you're
but they're
stealing
being
from
subsidized.
you're stealing from the nation's future, right? It's like a mortgage. I mean, these dictators are mortgaging the future of their country by selling off the oil or resources or labor of the present. Yeah, that's what's happening.
Yeah, and it's interesting because when you're in power, usually, at least traditionally, what you have to do was, use the resources of your country to, fund yourself. But now a lot of these governments can use the, like, sort of take out a mortgage against their future and the future labor of their country to get funding right now. And of course, this sort of like very high time preference behavior ends up getting rewarded because they get billions of dollars that they don't have to worry about paying back because they'll be long gone by then. It's
Well, this is
such a
also a
strange trade
deeper
system.
comment on the way that fiat currency detaches us from the physical world, like in the way that the financial system creates money through lending and not deposits. I mean, that allows a much more rapid excavation of the minerals and wealth that we have buried in the Earth's crust and in the lands all around us. So, you know, the system has enabled, for example, situations where you'll have 10, 20, 30 years of a very valuable substance underneath, whether it's uranium in Niger, gold in West Papua New Guinea, Indonesia, where a foreign company, whether it be the French or the Americans or whatever, will extract 90% of the value from this mine, which is like one of the most valuable things that country has. It's a huge resource. And then the local corrupt government will take a kickback of 10%. And then the people who actually live in the area over like where the stuff is, the people who have the biggest moral claim to the stuff get zero. And this is and it's gone by the time they realize it. Like by the time they know what's going on, all the uranium's been stolen and been used to develop France. All the gold has been stolen from West Papua and it's gone to enrich people in America. So, I mean, these are real stories I'm telling. This has actually happened. So, the ability of our financial system to create wealth instantly through loans and lending has led to this in many ways, a detachment or a divorce between physical, scarce assets and imaginary money.
Well, so one of the things that that this whole system sort of encourages, and you put this very well in chapter six, I think it was A Dance with Dictators, and you talk
Yes.
about how a lot of these organizations actually prefer working with dictators because they're way more compliant rather than a democracy. Can you explain that a little
bit? Well, they don't need to. Yeah. And like we can comment, you know, we can debate, you know, the complexities here. But generally speaking, the IMF would prefer to lend to a country that does not have an independent judicial system. They would prefer to lend to a country that has no labor unions. They would prefer to lend to a country that has no independent media. This way, the government can just like squeeze the population, impose the austerity, and be done with it. You know, once you start getting into, oh my God, there's a lawsuit, and oh my God, the unions are negotiating for higher wages, and oh my God, there's a leaked, you know, report on our loan conditions. Like, that's bad for the IMF. So the horrible irony is that they would prefer to work with tyrants.
And not just like work with them. They're basically partnering up with them to like extract the resources of the people. And they get a big kickback, and the dictators are strengthened as a result.
You know, the common response is, well, I mean, who was going to lend that country money? I mean, someone's got to lend that country money. And I think that that might be fair. I mean, in many cases, these institutions were set up because no private capital wanted to like invest in some of these places. I understand that. But if that's the case, then we should be clear about what these institutions are. And we should dispense with all the altruistic nonsense. They are basically banks that lend, and they try to make their incentive is to make money. And their incentive is not to promote human rights or to end poverty. Let's just be clear. Like if the IMF and World Bank wanted to just rebrand and make it clear to the public what they do, I would have a lot less problem with it. The problem is they've led people to believe that they're supposed to be altruistic, so that when we go and we dig around and we see the data and we see that they're actually not enriching countries, we say, oh my God, they're like doing it wrong. They made a mistake. They're corrupt. And we're not realizing, no, they're doing it right. They're just not doing what they are saying that they're doing. like, you know, they are doing it correctly. The fact that you have wage stagnation or real wage devaluation even in some of these global majority countries after decades of IMF policy is not a mistake. It is the intended outcome of the policy. And that's the crazy part.
Well, so thinking about this a little more and gaming this out a little bit, part of the incentive that you outlined is that this debt continues after the current regime is disposed. So you gave the example of Marcos and Philippines and so on. But this is a common thing where the
Nigeria, IMF, 80% of Nigeria's GDP last year, it's the largest country in Africa, 80% went to paying back debt.
That they didn't occur, right? Like it wasn't even the same
people
government.
I mean, basically there were no free and fair elections for the vast majority of that debt borrowing. I mean, you had Abacha. I mean, it's a horrible dictator. And then there's other guys in there, but the point is, like, even if you had a moment of democracy there, the average Nigerian did not like vote. I mean, it's not like they're communicating on a daily basis with their constituents saying, hey, you know, we're thinking of like going into debt to do this stuff. Like, are you okay with this? Like that doesn't even happen in America. Forget Nigeria. These are illegitimate loans is the point. And, you know, the point is that the question is how much of the world's credit is illegitimate? And, you know, even if we were to apply, I mean, of course, there are some like anarcho-capitalists that'll say all of it, you know, that's fine. But, you know, let's even just try to apply some sort of standard here of just saying, well, okay, if you have a country that has property rights and free speech and free and fair elections, like maybe we could argue that the lending is done, you know, with the permission of the public. I don't think that's entirely accurate, but it's at least some sort of standard we could try to adhere to. It doesn't that does not help the situation. Even if you use a rubric like that, the fact is such a large percentage of the world's credit and debt is illegitimate. It's
right.
It
was
odious.
Incurred by dictators, people that were
agreed to
did
borrow.
Not have sin.
The borrowers did not agree. There was no consent. And it's different from taxes. Like, okay, so we have this whole debate about paying tax in the United States. I mean, taxpayers in the United States get a lot of benefits. a lot of benefits. Maybe they don't agree to them. Maybe they think it's corrupt or spent wrong. And, oh, I'm protesting. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. You do that. This is very different. These people in these other countries are never asked. They don't get any benefits. In fact, their benefits get stripped away. So it's very different than the moral debate about taxation in the United States. Mm-hmm. This is a debate about people in some poor country who are getting their livelihood ground to a halt, who are losing their subsidies, who are losing their benefits, who are getting the monetary technology that they earn their wages and destroyed and reduced. And they have no idea what's going on. No one's ever asking them. And in fact, it's some foreign power or corporation that's doing it. That's the most outrageous part.
Well, so it occurs to me that because of this sort of like inheritance of the debt, whenever you take over a government or something like that, what one of the consequences might be that when a country wants to split up, they're more or less prevented from doing so by the other sort of like forces that want to keep the debt perpetual. Because if you do break up Nigeria into like four separate pieces or something like that, who gets the debt? So like that seems to me like a major portion of why a lot of countries continue being so big, and like sort of like this desire to have smaller countries, I think, is there for an independence on the part of a lot of smaller regions is there. But they're not really allowed to do so because of this international monetary order that wants this debt to continue, this credit that's been sent out.
I mean, as far as like a solution, like we don't know. Mm-hmm. I think a reasonable solution would be cancel the debt, cancel illegitimate debt. I mean, that would help. That would help a lot. I mean, because if Nigeria, let's say we like, the people who Nigeria owed got together and said, all right, well, 60% of this debt was incurred by dictators, so we're going to wipe that off. So all of a sudden, if Nigeria had to only do 40% of its GDP towards debt instead of 80, well, that would help a lot. That would make that country much more richer and prosperous if it could direct its resources and revenue towards actually moving forward instead of paying back the past. But that's never happening. And that's why I think Bitcoin is such an interesting thing to throw into the mix here, because it really truly requires a total paradigm break to change this. Like, we're only getting deeper and deeper and deeper into the debt trap. I mean, and the crazy part is once the debt trap is built, it has these features, like the people who control the debt trap continue to benefit from issuing debt, and the people who are on the other end continue to get screwed. So for example, when the US has a problem and it raises interest rates to try and quell inflation, which it did at the beginning of the 80s and it's doing again now, people in the global majority get completely screwed. I mean, you had what was called the third world debt crisis in the 80s, where tens of millions of people ended up starving. And you're having a horrible political crisis now globally, based partly on the back of currency devaluation. And it's connected in some way to every crisis. I mean, you look at, there's the obvious ones like Iraq, Sri Lanka, where you know, presidents were tossed out. But you look around and, you know, almost every hotspot politically has something, there's something going on with the currency. That's, I mean, even Israel has a collapse, like their currency's collapsing. Like there's problems happening when you have a system where everybody's tied to the dollar and you make the dollar a lot more expensive, and that's like the reference rate for everybody else, and everybody else's fiat gets more expensive as a result. It's really bad. So, you know, again, we have this system where that you have an unelected elite group of private bankers who run the Fed here in the United States. They get to decide. Well, there was another meeting yesterday, right? And they decided they're not going to hike. Okay, well, who gives them the right to decide that for people in Nigeria? I mean, it's completely ridiculous. But they make these decisions. Everybody else around the world has to suffer or benefit. It depends. But the point is that you bring in Bitcoin, Bitcoin takes that power away from them. They can no longer turn the knob. I mean, we're removing the knob, basically. And you know what? Yeah. Like, who knows? Maybe the world is worse. I'm not sure. But like, I think that it just can't be a moral construct for a small group of people who constitute 4% of the world population to be able to dictate the monetary terms of something that's relevant to every single person in the world. The other 96% all use money, and that money is changed by the decision-making of these people. I mean, they have no right to do that. So again, whether you think that the system was devised insidiously, conspiracy created in public, whatever, or whether you think it was, well, this is just how it sort of evolved this way. Fine, doesn't matter. The fact is that people are suffering under it in this way. Most people suffer. The numerical majority of people suffer by far. So if we all of a sudden have a new system where that is, it's different, where you cannot just simply issue loans with no cost to change other countries and make them dependent on you and do this whole double loan thing. If the base currency of the world that all the other, let's say, monies and financial instruments are based on is neutral and open and limited, then, you know, the not manipulatable, basically, then a lot of this starts to change. I mean, we don't really know because it hasn't happened. We're just all speculating. But clearly, it can't work in the same way. I mean, you can't have a debt empire in the same way. The U.S., which obviously is the engine of the IMF and World Bank, like, we're a $33 trillion debt empire. That's only possible with a fiat system. So, you know, what really should be happening is the U.S. should be a creditor power, like other creditor powers going way back. But we've made this other world where we export fiat. That's our major export, right? And it has led to just a bizarre structure inside the United States, which benefits the 1%, and then it has led to like massive suffering elsewhere. I don't think there's any immediate solution here. I think that any sort of shift to a Bitcoin standard is going to take a long time. But I do think there's some light at the end of the tunnel here for countries. And one of the bigger interesting points is that currently, again, as I was mentioning before, the only way you can pay back debt in dollars or buy fertilizer in dollars or do any of the valuable things that a government really needs to do, they need dollars, right? They can't use their local fiat currency to do that. I mean, even the Europeans can't buy certain things in euros. They have to get dollars. So there's this enormous pressure that's keeping the dollar like artificially valuable, right? Okay. Well, what if it's not a cure-all, but like it's very interesting to consider. What if Malawi or Ghana all of a sudden, or Indonesia or Philippines, what if they could turn their energy into the world reserve currency? You know, what if they could mine their geothermal power, their fossil fuels that they have, their whatever they have. What if they could turn that into the reserve currency without asking permission from any other country? Now, obviously, some countries are going to benefit more from this than others. Tiny countries don't have as much energy production as bigger ones. Some bigger ones are more well-endowed than others. But it's different from the gold. Like, not every country had gold, right? Every country has power, right? Every country has some kind of energy that it can harness. So even the tiniest ones have something. So this idea that, like, they could create what essentially dollars without having to trade with the United States is a very interesting construct because everything's marginal, right? So if they can even just create marginal amount of the reserve currency, that's way better than being able to marginally create zero. So I think it's going to have such a massive impact on the global trading system. And I think it's going to be very good.
Well, so let's talk about that a little bit, because I think what you touched on is very interesting in that if you do have, you know, more countries going on the gold standard, then by extension, I think we would expect the dollar to debase. And since all of these loans are denominated in the dollar, if the dollar starts hyperinflating, then the loans are cheaper to pay back. Is that
the what's also true though is that all these other fiats are going to melt faster than the dollar. So. Let's take Bangladesh again. Bangladesh screwed unless it figures out that they should be getting some Bitcoin, like or gold. Let's just say, like if they don't do that for whatever reason, they remain ignorant to that, or they remain against that, and there might be good reasons for them politically to not want widespread use of Bitcoin in their country. You know, they may lose control over part of it, but if they ignore that, then they're going to be sitting there with a nominal. Crazy increase in the amount of debt they owe based on exchange rates, because there'll be a nominal and there'll be a real impact here. Nominal will just be simply that like the Bangladeshi currency is going to depreciate against the dollar a lot. and the dollar, let's say, is inflating a lot, that's just going to be impossible for them to pay back. And then in real terms, you know, they'll also be at a huge loss, because they won't have a different currency to be able to pay back the dollar debt with. Now, if instead you take a Bitcoin strategy here and start building up a Bitcoin reserve as a nation, I mean, it makes no sense to pay back any of the debt, like, in the immediate term. You just start building up a Bitcoin position as a nation, or you start building Bitcoin mining infrastructure and creating some sort of way to create Bitcoin. I mean, nations that are thinking carefully should be doing this already. And there's, as you know, there's some that are already doing this, but this is going to give such a massive advantage when that ice cube starts to melt, you know?
Well, so if they do, you know, go on a Bitcoin standard, I mean, do you think
they can pay back the debt, and then the debt pyramid starts to deleverage, man? I mean, it's going to deleverage anyway, because you're going to either have bankruptcy from the countries that don't have any Bitcoin, that can't pay back the loans. There, it reaches a point where eventually you won't be able to make more debt to pay it back. Like, it's just going to collapse. Or they have a lot of Bitcoin and they're like, oh yeah, I can easily pay back, like, you know, $300 trillion of American debt. Like, that's not a big deal for us. So I think that either way, you have a deleveraging in nominal terms, in dollar terms. Like, you have a dollar deleveraging globally, is where we're headed. And that's either really bad for you if you don't have any Bitcoin or gold, or it's really good for you if you have Bitcoin or gold, or arguably, like, other commodities, right? Like, if you have oil or any sort of tradable scarce good, you know, it's probably good for you, but especially Bitcoin and gold, right?
Well, so why don't some of these countries? I mean, the part that's a little bit confusing for me is, why don't some of these countries that are in, say, $100 billion of debt, why don't they just say, screw you, we're not going to pay it back? Like, what are the consequences right now, and how do those consequences change as we go on more of a Bitcoin?
But the incentive is that the government in charge, why the hell would they do that? Mm-hmm. They want the debt. They want more. Mm-hmm. They're more than happy to indebt their future nation to borrow more. They want more of that sweet dollars. I mean, that's what they need to, again, buy weapons to put down protests and buy oil for their machinery and for their elite population, etc. Like, they don't want to cut off the spigot. They want more debt. Like, that's the incentive here. I mean, there's also
a carrot dangling of new debt.
Yeah, but it's also like, it's hard. Once you're in the system, it's hard to get out. Like, think about it this way. Let's say you... I mean, Argentina tried to do this. You should, like, about 20 years ago, it ended up they were unable to get out of the debt trap. They ended up borrowing more. But let's say you decide to, say, oh, we're not going to pay back, and you refuse the new debt. You're some sort of moral leader. Well, either A, you're going to get killed. Like, this has happened many times. Like, look at Sankara. There's many examples of leaders that tried to present a different way of doing things, and they would just get assassinated or whatever. The revolutionary founder of the Congo, et cetera, Patrice Lumumba. So all these guys who tried to say, no, we're going to do it differently. I mean, they ended up basically getting killed. But let's say you don't get killed and you're like, we're just not going to borrow anymore. We're not going to pay you back. I mean, basically what happens is they're like, American, European, Japanese kind of corporate structure, like, refuses to do business with you. So the system is hard to get out of. It's real difficult. It's a big trap, because there might be sanctions on you all of a sudden if you don't want to comply, right? So, or from a market perspective, no one else is going to lend you any money either. Now, you can, of course, always issue bonds, and bonds have become a much larger part of the debt of these poor countries over the last 20 years. It used to be mainly foreign lending, but now it's a lot of bonds. But, you know, then you're at the mercy of the bond market, and you're at the mercy of bond traders, and, you know, that in the end may not be that much better.
All right, so I want to talk about one final thing, and that is what you term green colonialism. Can you explain what that is to our audience?
Yeah, well, basically, like colonialism was built in a major way to harvest energy resources from poor countries for rich countries. Mm-hmm. Just to be blunt about it, I mean, we would go and take mm-hmm. oil and coal or whatever mm-hmm. from faraway places to enrich our own societies and it exponentially increase our way of life. I mean, each barrel of oil is like 500 whatever man hours. It's a massive, massive subsidy for civilization. So that is something that we did. I mean, we became advanced by stealing other people's oil in many ways, or by getting it very cheaply, right? So once we started encountering problems with that, we suffered huge inflation, actually. So if you look at the 70s, one of the big reasons we had huge inflation in the 1970s was that all of a sudden we didn't control the oil anymore, or a lot of it. Mm. We used to control it through the Seven Sisters, Western corporations. And then through the late 1960s and early 1970s, you had the end of colonialism. And all of a sudden these countries in the Middle East and stuff, they controlled the oil production. And they decided to raise the cost to what they thought was a fair price. And the cost of oil in dollar terms went up by like 4x. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's like it's really, really wild. It didn't necessarily go up in gold terms that much, actually, if you look mm-hmm. at it, but it definitely went up in dollar terms big time. So we had huge inflation here. And there's also a there's a argument to be made that the Great Depression, if you go back, you look at three historical moments, like history rhymes, right? So mm-hmm. one of the reasons we may have also had the Great Depression is like the economic core of the world at that time was Britain. And they had been looting India for the longest time. You know, India used to be the richest country in the world. Britain looted it until it was the richest country. And that flow of resources and energy and things like that was hugely lucrative and very important for Britain's wealth. So that started to break down. And then, you know, hey, look, the world's biggest economic power all of a sudden is getting a slower conveyor belt of resources. Like, oh, that's going to cause issues. Mm-hmm. So that is like one big part, I think, of why the crisis in the late 20s and early 30s happened. Then you have what I just described in the 70s with the energy crisis. Now you have globalization breaking down. Globalization is like basically an extension or an expansion of this idea of Western countries being able to harvest resources from poor countries in an unfair way. That's starting to break down a little. There's like new entities asserting sovereignty, et cetera. So that's going to lead to more inflation here. So you've had three examples in the last century of like, you know, we have this way of doing things where we can get stuff for cheap and then it starts to break down and then we get more inflation. I mean, it really highlights the nature of the system. But I think that that's, you know, kind of where we're headed is a world where we, you know, we're a little less able to do this at scale.
So are we continuing that with green colonialism?
Yeah. So that's like the background context. Green colonialism refers to this idea of like, we are going to force you to not use your fossil fuels and instead to buy expensive renewable technology from us. Mm. So, for example, you might have a poor country that has a lot of coal or natural gas or fossil fuel or whatever. And even though we've been digging the crap out of ours for the longest time, right? Like we use, I mean, come on, give me a break. The reason why we didn't go into an economic crisis in the mid-2000s after the Great Financial Crisis was fracking. I mean, we came up with a new way to harvest more fossils in America. So we're like a fossil empire, right? So we've been doing that for the longest time. Britain's been doing that for the longest time. BP, Royal Dutch Shell, all this stuff. Okay, so we've been harvesting. We then go to these poor countries and say, listen, if you want to take our loans or you want to be part of our security alliance or whatever, you can't use your fossils. Maybe you can sell them to us. We'll take them. But you can't use them. And not only that, we're going to give you money. We're going to lend you money, which you'll have to pay back, of course, at a high interest rate. Mm-hmm. And with that money, you can buy our solar panels or China's solar panels, or you can buy our wind things or whatever. I'm being a little cynical here, but this is certainly happening in to an extent. I mean, this is green colonialism. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's like this idea of imposing the energy, the type of energy on different countries, dictating what kind of energy other countries can use, and rigging it in a way, just like we've been discussing, in a way that everything else is rigged, trade, food, whatever, so that they're more dependent on us, so that they're less sovereign. It's all about sovereignty. I mean, it's all about sovereignty for the individual. Well, look, it's also all about sovereignty for the nation. I mean, and that's really what it comes down to.
Well, so we've covered how food is used to induce dependence. Energy is used to induce dependence,
Absolutely.
and a lot of the banking and sort of
Money.
debt and stuff like that, that's used to induce dependence. Are there any things going in the other direction? Are there any sort of like I don't know, technologies or categories that that give these countries a glimmer of hope? Because in a sense, the picture that you've drawn is very dire. Like you're not going to get
It's
out
very
of this
dire.
debt. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, look, look, again, some of this becomes unsustainable. And I just went through how, I mean, India becoming a bigger economy than Britain is like, historical justice in some ways, right? Like they're going to get out of it by becoming more sovereign and developing. And the only way to really develop is to like not follow the Washington consensus. It's to like do things, it's to basically do what we did, which is funny. And I know that's a different conversation, but like, I don't know. In our world, we don't live in Adam Smith's world. We live in a hyper-competitive, very rigged world. And the way that Western societies developed to the extent that they did was by having massive subsidies on their food industries, massive tariffs on trade, and by stealing other people's commodities, resources, metals, and fossil fuels, or by getting it very cheaply. So that's how we developed. So look, that's how they're going to have to develop too, right? That's the only way to really develop is to try and like rig the game. I mean, that the game's rigged. I mean, you can't compete as a fair player in a game that's rigged. I mean, you'll lose every time, and that's the sad part. And that's an interesting reflection on what we would call capitalism or let's say free trade. Like, it doesn't really work if everybody else isn't playing by the same rules. So it's kind of an interesting thing to think about at the global scale. But the fact is, these countries are going to have to do what we did. They're going to have to erect trade barriers. Indonesia right now is saying, no, sorry, you can't buy our metals at super cheap rates. We're going to use them and we're going to make batteries and cars and you're going to buy them from us. And to do that, it has to be a massive violator of free market capitalist principles. But it's interesting because that's what we did. And that's how we became super rich and advanced and prosperous. So there's a lot of interesting reflection here on that kind of stuff. For me, I'm just like, I think it's what Indonesia should totally do. I don't think they should continue selling off their precious stuff to us for pennies. I think they should harness it and become sovereign. Now there's better and worse ways of doing that, but I'm very like, it's all about creating industry so that you can build economies of scale with things to sell to other people. I mean, that's how these countries became so powerful. So we'll see. I do think that's happening, but I don't think that's enough. And I think these countries will remain kind of subservient because of the monetary structure. So, I mean, at the end of the day, the Bitcoin gives me hope because it gives us a new paradigm where everybody's equal and everybody's playing by the same rules, and you can't do the rigging thing because it's Bitcoin. Like, what are you going to do? Everybody can create a little bit of Bitcoin with their energy. Nobody can print more. There's not one little country that has control of everybody else. Sure, maybe America can mint paper Bitcoin that's worth more than Indonesia's paper Bitcoin. But what do we know about paper Bitcoin? Eventually you get wrecked. So I don't know, man. I mean, I think I'm pretty optimistic that it's going to be a pretty seismic change and for the better.
Well, when you were saying all of that, it made me think like, okay, so it is possible for some of these countries to maybe get out from under some of this. But I mean, in a sense, the game is already rigged against them because the commodities that they're selling sort of under market value, and they're not really developing. And the one example, it's kind of crazy to me, of somebody that's been able to like sort of rig the game for themselves is China. Like they've essentially been able to you know, harness a lot of their own resources instead of getting under the IMF thumb. Is that what's required?
I would say that's not a great example because they actually are hyper dependent on a lot of things. Like they're not very sustainable. I mean, they import, they're relying on food and energy imports. So, and maybe that's geographical fate. I don't know. But the point is that like, they're very dependent. It's very fragile. And it's true they've made a lot of things, but they have not really chosen to. I mean, they've chosen to build a society of fear instead of a society of freedom. And that, I think, eventually is not going to work out for them.
I agree that it won't work. It's just that they've, as you point out in the book, they've managed to kind of become part of the creditor class.
Well, they're trying. Well, yes, they're absolutely. They're trying to copy what we've done. Now, they can't do it quite as effectively because they don't mint the reserve currency. So it's a little tricky. Mm-hmm. Like, it's harder to get Saudi Arabia to agree to buy oil in RMB, or rather to sell it to China for RMB, because then what the hell does Saudi Arabia do with all this RMB? Like, then, okay, fine. Okay, it could buy Chinese technology or AI services or whatever. Okay, maybe. But, like, they don't have the same luxury as we do, like, where we can just literally print dollars and then these countries all want dollars. Like, nobody wants RMB. The RMB only constitutes about 2% of the world reserve in terms of currency composition. So for all this hype about China becoming the next, no. And it's not going to happen because they don't want to be the world reserve currency. They want to close capital market. They want to have control over their economy. They don't want to open up. So it's not very likely that that's going to happen. It's true that China did develop like by isolating and by indifferent. But you look at, you know, honestly, you look at a country like Korea, I would say it's a much better example of a country that did not create a genocide and go into Orwell's 1984 and steal all the rights from its people. I mean, there's problems with Korea. I'm talking about the Republic of Korea, of course. But in general, they strategized an economic growth and global cultural growth strategy in a way that wasn't according to the Washington consensus neoliberal way. And they did pretty well. I mean, South Korea is amazing. I mean, Seoul is a hugely cosmopolitan city. Korean culture has really dominated abroad in terms of food and cinema and dramas and music. Some of the most famous music in the world is Korean. They've won Oscars recently. Their dramas are the most watched in the whole global South next to Bollywood. So this relatively small country is so dominant. And I think there's a lot of lessons there. I mean, from that maybe we can look at. So I would look at maybe Korea as an interesting model rather than China.
No, I would say, though, that they have had problems with the IMF, the crisis in 98 and so on.
They've kind of refused to and look, a lot of this is because they've been allowed to do this because we have 30,000 troops there and they're under our security umbrella. But they have refused to just sell us random crap like basics. Like, they have developed highly, highly specialized industries. And look at Samsung, LG, Hyundai. It's just amazing. So, look, they're doing something right.
All right. So, I think we've covered most of the book and all of the different things. I would encourage anybody listening to the show, if you're interested in like the way this stuff actually works, I would highly recommend this book because it's such a good way to sort of have something that's readable that people can understand, because almost everything written about the IMF and World Bank are in sort of complete economic jargon that's very difficult to get through, and you know, lots of facts and statistics and numbers which don't really tell the whole story, which I think you've done a very good job with. What are you hoping is the result of this book? What do you want people to do as a result of reading this book?
I mean, I would like people to educate themselves about how we've become so advanced as societies, and maybe reflect on that a little bit. How sustainable is this exactly? Especially as we talk about all of these transitions to a more sustainable world. I mean, well, what does that really mean? And who's going to benefit and who's going to pay the costs? I think it's just worth reflecting on, you know, what has had to happen for you to get to where you are as a nation. I think that is worth, that's worth me writing the book, is just to get people to think a little harder about this. I think, look, I'm not that bullish on like any reforms at the IMF or World Bank. I mean, they're going to ignore this and continue to just keep lending because of course they're going to. But I do think that Bitcoin, again, presents a pretty exciting opportunity to break the paradigm and force this thing onto its knees. So that's pretty cool.
So the hope is in Bitcoin, in other words.
Totally. Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Alex.
Gold's not going to do it. The IMF is the world's third largest holder of gold, by the way, which I talk about in the book. But yeah, gold failed. So, but maybe Bitcoin can succeed. We'll see.
Okay. So where can people find you? Where can they download this book or buy it? And yeah, where
sure, can you can get it on Amazon, Hidden Repression. You can also buy it with Bitcoin at the Bitcoin Magazine store. There's a Kindle version now. There's a sweet-looking hardcover. This is what it looks like. I loved the design that the team did. It's very kind of simple. How the IMF and World Bank sell exploitation as development. So it was designed to be provocative.
Is that the same font as the HRF or something, or no?
It is. Yeah, not really sure, but it looks cool. We got some great feedback from Jeff Booth and Saifedean and my friend Farida on the back cover. So yeah, check it out. And thank you very much for having me, Jimmy. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for coming on. All right. Let's wait. How do I? Okay, there we go.